Well, much effort has been devoted to getting children to eat the right food, but in spite of all the effort, much of the right food ends up in the trash. This leads us to ask, should children be forced to eat what parents serve, or should parents be forced to serve what children eat?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1044th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Aberdeen who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metroforum.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
My pleasure to roll with.
Jason, I have a question for you.
Fire away, sir.
Should children be forced to eat what parents serve, or should parents be forced to serve what children eat?
You know, that's a pretty tough one. I'd have to go along the lines of somewhere in the middle.
And what happened to your mother when she tried to serve you a hot dog when you were 2 years old?
I decided I did not want to eat meat anymore, and she threw the hot dog at my head.
There it was. So there she was bound and determined to force you to eat what she wanted you to eat, right?
That's right.
All right. Also with us today, producer Dylan Hunsinger. Dylan, what about you?
I think that children should be forced to eat what parents want to serve them.
Uh-huh. And if they were trying to serve you, like, hot dogs and you didn't want to eat the hot dogs, then what? I mean, if you refused to eat what your parents wanted you to eat, what then?
I'm going to go with the old-fashioned wisdom that they will eat it eventually. They will not starve themselves to death.
Okay. Well, folks, it was most likely our very first rebellion against parental authority and our first grab at controlling our very own lives. This happened way back when we were very young, when the parents placed a healthy serving of mashed broccoli and potato in front of us and then looked on in anticipation. We considered their offering and wondered, am I supposed to eat that stuff? Being hungry, we did give it a try. What's this bitter green stuff? It isn't sweet, and I hate bitter. And so we pushed the bowl off into the floor and let out with a wah! Well, then we took note of the parents' terrified expressions and realized for the very first time that we had gained a way to get some control of our lives and our parents. From that childhood moment on, it was really us against the adults, with the adults trying to get us to eat the foods they thought were right, and us wanting to eat the foods we thought were right. The give and take between what adults wanted us to eat and what we wanted to eat taught us how to eat, and we likely held on to those food preferences, for better or worse, until well into adulthood. This give and take between parents and children leads us to ask, should parents be forced to eat what parents serve? Oops, should children be forced to eat what parents serve? Or should parents be forced to serve what children eat? Two different ways of looking at it. Here, today we tried to get the author of First Bite, B. Wilson, to join us. Incredible story about learning how we learn how to eat, which is, if you think about it, a most interesting process. And B had some incredible stories to tell about that process. But B is in Cambridge, England, and our efforts to reach through, that's probably her right now. Nope. Our efforts to reach her proved inconclusive, and so she's out there hanging on the line somewhere in the world. So maybe we'll get her and maybe we won't, but we'll proceed as we can. I guess that might have been her. Who knows? Well, folks, so here we are. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson, without B. Wilson, but we have you. And I think if you look back on your life, you probably learned how to eat some way or another. Maybe your parents tried to force you into eating something. Maybe they didn't. I don't remember quite how my teaching went, but I'm here with a healthy appetite for just about everything except eggplant. I don't know about eggplant, but I'm just not in favor of eggplants. It seems like we all have some kind of antipathy towards some kind of food. What about you, Dylan? What don't you like?
You know, I have never been much of a fan of seafood, and I think I would attribute that to the fact that growing up, my family didn't eat a lot of seafood, and maybe the occasional, like, fish sticks or fish and chips, but I think the best example for me is I do not like lobster. I've tried it a couple of times. I'm not allergic to it. I just don't like it. So I've always found it really interesting when people talk about how good lobster is because I've never shared in that.
You never had that taste memory, right? You didn't know. It's what you don't know is something that you're afraid of. And I guess that's the real interesting thing is that how do we learn about which foods are good and which foods are bad?
Well, and I think with taste memory, you really get it. You said correctly there of it's not that I don't like seafood, like it's repulsive to me. It's that it's just slightly off. Like it's slightly off. Something about it's just a little bit uncanny.
Well, you know, that's the interesting that Bea Wilson, the point she makes in First Bite is that our whole central nervous system is pretty much wired to help us remember what's good and what's bad. Beginning with our sense of smell, which is so much of what taste is how we smell things. 5% of our genes are designed to help us smell and to remember what we smell. So that's a huge percent of our makeup, our genetic makeup. 5% of all of those genes are designed to help us smell and remember things. And a point she also makes, of course, is that there are only two things that we start life with, and that's the attraction to those things that are sweet and the fear of those things that are bitter. And, of course, the reason we fear things that are bitter is that's because how poisons taste are bitter. So,
and it might just be anecdotal, but I seem to remember hearing that there's nothing in nature that is sweet and poisonous.
There you go. And also the point B makes is that our education starts long before we are born. And it starts when we're in the mother's womb, and a lot of what we remember is what mother ate, because that is transferred from her into the amniotic fluids that feed us. And so what mother eats and drinks when she's carrying us around is factored into our memory. So we're born with the knowledge of some things, and she quotes a survey, a scientific survey in which they kept track, real close track of what mothers ate and from what part of the country they came from. And then when the newborn babies were born, they were given the scents to smell. And those babies who came from mothers who were fed certain foods and that smell was passed under their nose, they would immediately start licking their lips and in hunger. Whereas when their other foods were passed in front of them, they were afraid of that smell and turned away from it. So it starts before we were born, and the education of how we eat starts right there. Then, of course, there's the mother's milk, and that's something I really wanted to talk with Bea about, but perhaps somebody else there can help us as well. The difference between mother's milk and formula milk, because that's also where we learn how to eat and what to eat because of what's in the mother's milk. All of those things are keyed into the scent and smell. And there we are. So that's what we're talking about today, folks. A question on the table for you. Should children be forced to eat what parents serve? A lot of parents think that's true. Young Dylan here thinks that's the way you have to do it. You have to put the food in front of the children, force them to eat it, They won't like it, but they'll come to like it. Or you can serve children what children want to eat. And there are a lot of people who think that the children's innate sense of hunger is the best judge of what their body is looking for. If your body's deficient in vitamin C, for example, your body will crave foods that bring you the vitamin C. So those are the two ways of looking at the way to teach children. And we're curious about what you think is the best way to do this. When you raised your children, how did you do it? Did you force them to eat what you wanted them to eat? Or did you put in front of them those foods that they were hungry for? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson right back to you. Stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5-6 or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city greenbelts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-6 or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain radio program. Michael Olson. We're looking for Bea Wilson to join us. She is the author of First Bite, how we learn to eat. If you think about it, Bea is in Cambridge, England, so we're trying desperately to make that connection. And we've got her on one line. We're trying to get her on the other line. Well, until we do, the question on the table is, why do we develop food phobias? And it seems like we all have a food phobia of some kind. We're all leery of eating one thing or another. Where does that come from? And that's the question on the table today. And I'm sure you have a food phobia, and I'm sure you developed one as well. But the question is, how did you develop one? A person I work with here has a really interesting story about Brussels sprouts. And she was raised in England, as well as Bea. And she was raised on a farm out in the countryside, had three big brothers. Every Sunday, the family would have this wonderful meal, get together and have the meal of the week, roast something and all the vegetables. And everybody would have to sit at the table until all of the food was eaten. Now, our Rosemary refused to eat the Brussels sprouts because she just did not like them. But she had three older brothers sitting at the table who could not get up until Rosemary ate her Brussels sprouts. So what the big brothers would do, one would pinch her nose and the other would shove the Brussels sprouts down her mouth and force her to chew them until such time as they were all gone. And that's how Rosemary developed a phobia and a hatred of Brussels sprouts that lasts to this day. And I guess perhaps we all suffer from something like that. And that's what we're working on. Oh, my goodness. We have an actual phone coming in here. Maybe. And the question is, how did you learn to eat? Were your parents the kind of parents who forced something on you? Or were they the kind of, hey, we're there. Holy smokes. Let's see. B, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am. Hi.
Oh, hot dog. I'm really happy to pull this one out of the fire because I've been looking forward to the show for a long time. And thank you, Jace, for pulling that off. And here we are. So, first bite. My question to you, Bea Wilson, you're a mother of three and author of several books, First Bite. What was your epiphany with respect to First Bite? You know, when you're walking down the street and thinking, I have to write this book.
I had so many epiphanies with this book, way more than anything else I've written. And it kept going even during the writing process. So as I say at some point in the introduction, I thought I was writing a book about children's food. And that is one of the subjects. It is about how we feed kids. But one of my epiphanies was suddenly thinking, hey, you know, all these problems that kids have with eating and also the joys that kids have with eating, it doesn't go away for us as adults, or at least for lots of people it doesn't. The problems of pickiness, the problems that we basically just give or take like the food that we like to eat, and we don't want to eat what we don't like. And for lots of people, that is a recipe for nutritional disaster. And I'd never really thought of it in those terms before. And the subtitle of the book, How We Learn to Eat, that was a huge epiphany, because when I began doing the research into sort of history of culture of how we feed and neuroscience, I didn't know to what extent this stuff was going to be nature and innate and genetic, and to what extent it was going to be nurture.
Well, there it is. What is it? Nature or nurture? I guess that's a question, you know, that I've been asking all through the show here, is should children be forced to eat what parents serve? And that would be nurture, of course. Or should parents be forced to serve what children eat? And that would be the nature.
Yeah. Well, it is a really complex interplay, and every child is different. And as the parent of three kids, I know that it's not equally easy to feed every child, so I'm by no means saying there are not kids who are born who are much fussier or have different issues with eating. You know, we know that kids on the autistic spectrum struggle with food in all kinds of ways that lots of families couldn't imagine, and there are case studies in my book of kids whose reactions to new foods are so extreme that if somebody enters a room just carrying a plate of food that they haven't tasted before, they spontaneously vomit. So that's clearly a different level of challenge than many sort of regular picky eaters. So I'm not saying there's no genetic component. By no means. We all occupy different worlds when it comes to flavor. We have different responses to bitterness, different responses to individual foods such as cilantro. But what I discovered again and again was that whether someone overall has a balanced and healthy relationship with food, that's nurture. That is something that, yes, you might not end up in the same place as everyone else, but you are capable of learning a variety of good, wholesome flavors that would enable you to feed yourself in a way that nourishes you and sustains you. And it is possible to overcome a dysfunctional relationship with food, no matter what your start in life, but it's difficult.
You know, the interesting thing to me is that it would seem from reading First Bite that the first bite takes place before we're born.
Yeah, this was a huge surprise to me, the extent to which we're learning about flavor even in utero. There have been a number of amazing experiments, mostly done by these biologists called Julie Minella and Gary Beauchamp, who are based in Pennsylvania. And they did one study where they got mothers who are mothers-to-be who are pregnant in the last trimester to drink a lot of carrot juice. And when their babies were born and had their first bites of solid food, they preferred cereal that tasted of carrots, which shows that those already amniotic fluid has a certain flavor. We know that mothers who eat a lot of garlic, that goes through into what the baby is experiencing as they're swimming around in this sack of fluid, which is, to me, that was an amazing thought, because those first bites, as you say, actually, they're not the first bites. We're already remembering something from our mother's diet when we're taking our first conscious bites of solid food.
And then we make the transition to mother's milk or formula.
Exactly. So one of the many reasons why breast milk is a good thing is that it has a varied flavor profile, and depending on what the mother is eating and drinking, it's going to taste different. Whereas formula, because it has this homogeneous taste, it seems to have a much greater power to imprint a certain sort of expectation of how milk should taste on the baby who's drinking it. And I'm not saying, you know, by the way, gave up breastfeeding with each of my three for one reason or another around 3 months. I didn't make it through to the six-month mark, which the World Health Organization recommends. So I'm by no means saying people should beat them up beat themselves up if formula is the route they've taken. But this stuff is interesting that there were studies done showing babies who were reared on a particular type of formula called hydrolysate, which is designed for kids who can't tolerate regular cow's milk formula. And to adults, hydrolysate milk tastes horrible. It's really sour. It's got a kind of stench, a bit like hay. But to the babies reared on it, it's like nectar. And this, to me, is a great model of how we all learn to eat. We sometimes imagine that there are certain flavors which are innately so delicious we won't be able to resist them. You know, things like candy or hamburgers or french fries or whatever it might be. But by and large, the foods that we love, they're a product of familiarity. They're what we know. And we can learn to love any flavor, even disgusting hydrolysate formula, if we're given it often enough in a loving spirit at an early age.
And before we take our next break here, we have to realize then much of what you're saying is that so much of our learning process takes place before we even start learning, you know, yes, before we're even sitting there getting lessons. Much
exactly
of what we will learn, we have learned.
Yeah, so one of our biggest problems with eating is, the subtitle of my book, How We Learn to Eat, I didn't think of my own likes and dislikes in those terms. I think loads of us don't. We think they're innate. We think they're just a part of ourselves, a part of our personality. And it's partly because so much of that learning, so much of that memory is embedded in the first 2 years of life before we're even conscious of it.
When we get back from this break, B. Wilson, I'd like to talk about that sweet spot when we're open to learning and how that closes. Michael Olson, Food Chain Radio Program, B. Wilson, author of First Bite, and you do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson. Today we're talking about how we learn to eat with B. Wilson, who is the author of First Bite, incredible story. I've been looking forward to doing this story for a long time. The book is well worth a read because it brings up all kinds of questions that, about our relationship with food and life and culture and family and everything else. Because food is a great metaphor for just about everything, and just about everything is in First Bite. B, you talk about a sweet spot in which we as human beings are open to different tastes, and that was when we were pretty young, right?
Yeah. It turns out that there is a kind of flavor window between the ages of really young, 4 months and 7 months, when human beings are more receptive to new flavors than they'll ever be again in their life. So if you're somehow able, if you're lucky enough not to have weaned your children yet, so there's still hope and chance to do so, to offer babies at that age tiny tastes of a range of different vegetables, which kind of goes against what most baby care books tell parents to do, which say start them off with really sweet, bland flavors like baby rice and sweet potato and butternut squash because kids will like those. Well, sure, they'll like those, but the real aim of feeding should be to expose them to flavors such as broccoli, spinach, or the ones that they might not like them. Because once they've been exposed to them, particularly at this age, it's possible for people to learn to like these things. It's just sometimes, as parents, it's hard for us to keep an open enough mind to believe, yes, my child could learn to love bitter flavors, but that's the age to do it when we're more receptive than we'll ever be again. It's not that the flavor window suddenly slams shut. We can learn to love these things at any age. It just gets harder.
It just gets harder and harder because we put the food in front of the children, and the children look at the food and they go, wah, and they throw it on the floor, and they look at the expressions on our face, and they realize that they've gained a way to gain control of their world just by watching us freak out, right?
There's definitely a huge amount of power that goes on. If you think, well, just how powerless a child, in fact, is at the table. They can't control the tone of voice in which their parent speaks to them. They can't control the food they're offered. The one thing they can control is the power to refuse or to accept. It's immense. And yes, they can see this big person reacting in a very emotional way to whether they're opening their mouth or closing it. And no wonder we're all a bit emotional around food. That's how we start off in life. Food and love and security and all these things are bound up together. And it's hard for parents and it's hard for kids. You can't unravel these things. And no wonder later on in life, a lot of us act as if sugar and love are the same thing.
And sugar and love, and which of course takes us into this relationship then of how parents present the food to the child. Because what do you do when the child rejects you? Then what do you do?
It's really difficult. It's really difficult to stay calm. And I know this myself. I made lots of mistakes, particularly with feeding my third child, who was born with cleft palate, which made me so much more anxious than I had been with the first two, and so much more desperate for him to eat a nourishing, wholesome diet, which he clearly sensed, and he had his own physical issues with food to do with a cleft palate, and I didn't help. There have been these groundbreaking, pioneering techniques over the past 10 years, which have been done both in feeding clinics, treating kids on the severe end of the picky eating spectrum, but also there have been a number of studies done trialing this in schools, in families, and it seems to be remarkably effective with pretty much any child. It sounds too simple to be true. The basic concept is tiny tastes. And I know that this totally changed the conversation around food with my own third child. And the idea is this, that you, as parents, we've all heard that thing, that if only you could offer the broccoli 10 times, the child would like it. But it's catch 22. You can't offer the broccoli the first time. They don't want to put it in their mouth. They don't want it anywhere near their mouth because they hate it. So even if you succeed in getting them to eat a mouthful, the battle isn't won because it's an unpleasant experience. And the exposures only work if they're positive exposures. But this idea of tiny tastes is, if the size of the food being tasted could be reduced to the size of a pea or even a grain of rice, it's possible for the child to put it in their mouth. And you don't attempt any more than that one tiny fragment. But if you then do that on successive days, well, they say attempt to do it for 14 days. I found, this is purely anecdotal, with my own son, by day 3 or 4, he was saying, I can't really taste this. Can I have a bigger piece, please? And at that point, you know, something has changed.
So you're really kind of making a deal, right? So if you try this, I'll do this?
You can do it as a deal as well. So it used to be thought that rewarding a child for tasting food is bad. And certainly the old game of saying, eat up your green vegetables and you can have some candy, isn't a great plan, though lots of us have done it, because it makes you like the candy more and like the green vegetables less. But one of the psychologists who's done this tiny taste idea with lots of children, especially in the UK, Dr. Lucy Cook, found that if you use stickers, they don't make you dislike the vegetable more. And the child does, if they really have struggled to taste the piece of raw red pepper or green bean, whatever it might be, they feel they deserve the sticker. Obviously, there's probably a point when you've outgrown that, if you're doing it with teenagers.
So you have to give them the keys to the car, right?
Something like that. we all have reward mechanisms.
Sure, sure.
Always something.
But the idea is tiny tastes.
The idea is tiny, tiny tastes. And there's another related idea which has been, which is completely brilliant. This one is very new. It's only been done by someone called Keith Williams, who runs a feeding clinic. And it's called Plate A, Plate B. And with this one, you put, again, tiny morsels. But Plate A contains three different tiny morsels of foods that the child doesn't like. Plate B is regular-sized portions of food that they do like. And you simply alternate mouthfuls. And this one I only really started trying after I'd finished writing the book, and again with my third child. And it's amazing. I think one of the biggest problems that kids have, but probably we have still as adults too, with foods that we don't like, is it's about contamination. You don't actually want that food on the plate. So keeping the disliked morsels on a separate plate, plate A, somehow gives you a sense of control. And maybe of those three foods, there are two which are just horrific and the child can't contemplate eating. But by choosing the third, it makes it seem more desirable.
Hmm.
So these are techniques. I mean, it's not saying it's perfect. It's not saying these things are easy to enact. It takes a lot of time. But it at least offers a kind of glimmer of a way out from those endless, unproductive arguments about food. which don't really convince anyone, because eating isn't a rational business. You can tell your child what's healthy, but it doesn't mean they want to have it.
It seems like control is an underlying, the ability of the child to gain control is an underlying theme here.
I think it's about control. I mean, I think we all want to feel in control when we eat, but also I think it's about pleasure to an extent that gets forgotten. There's so much of our conversation about how to feed ourselves as adults, but also how to feed kids, is about what are the healthy choices? How can we get them to make the healthy choices? But that's all very well, but you're only going to make the healthy choices when you enjoy healthy food.
Oh, boy, and that takes us on down the road to kidhood. And so when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about foods designed for children and their impact on how the children eat. Folks, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Today we're talking about how we learn to eat with the author of First Bite, Bea Wilson, live from Cambridge, England. And you do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain radio program. We're talking about how we learn to eat with Bea Wilson, author of First Bite, and you. Phone number today, 831-479-1080. And so we have a caller tuning in. We have Caprice. Caprice, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, thank you so much. I've always enjoyed your show for years and years, Michael. Thank you. Well, one thing is just to share my own experience, but I do also have a couple questions about my grandson's eating. But and I love the sound of your book. I can't wait to get it. I teach a program called Life Lab, you might be familiar with, at Gateway School in Santa Cruz, and children grow their own food in our quarter-acre garden there. And one of the things, of course, is growing your own food. It's an amazing transformation. I've had parents tell me, oh, Caprice, now we have to buy spaghetti squash, and they want to make their own pesto because they did it in Life Lab. And it just has transformed, apparently, a lot of kids' eating by being able to grow it and eat it right out of the garden. Probably the other thing is the mindful tastings we do, trying the small amounts like you describe, where kids not only grow it, but they harvest it, cut it themselves, and then serve it to each other, and we sit together almost in celebration, which you're bringing up a really important point, almost celebrating that food or the prepared food if we've cooked it too, and sit together and really focus on the flavors, so either silently or, you know, just even chatting about it is often fun, about the flavors they notice or how it tastes in different parts of their mouths. It's really quite an experience to have this in a garden. So that has just been really a great point. So I wondered if your book got into the growing and tasting of food.
Bea?
Yeah, I love the sound of the mindful tastings. I think that's wonderful because I think the thing of growing food is incredibly powerful, as is cooking in schools. But one of the things I discuss in my final chapter, which is called Change, is ways in which both individuals and whole societies can change. And one of the inspiring examples I have is of Finland, where around 10 years ago, they noticed that they had worse rates of child obesity compared to their neighbors in the rest of Scandinavia, and they changed their whole preschool system. It sounds very similar to what you're doing, to have children exploring food through all their senses. So it wasn't by any means about having lectures on healthy eating. It was just the sort of things you're describing. It was sessions on different vegetables. It was talking about sweet, sour, salty, and bitter, and children talking about how the different flavors made them feel. And it seems to have had a benign knock-on effect on child obesity levels plateauing or dropping, but also just what you're describing, that the kids were going home and saying to their parents, we tasted these amazing purple vegetables called beets, and they turned the cooking water purple, and can we please have some of those?
Oh, yeah, it is. It's quite interesting, and I have to say, after doing this 29 years, the first years I was more like my mother, where everything was manja, you got to try everything, manja, eat it all. But I stopped at about, three or four years in, and I said, and in Life Lab at Gateway, we have a rule, you don't have to eat anything. And ever since, I've been saying you don't have to eat anything from kindergarten through eighth grade, they've eat everything.
Mm.
It's very rare, so I take the whole power.
Yes, that paradox. That's exactly right that as soon as you can remove any feeling, even an atmosphere of coercion from the feeding situation, it becomes better. It becomes better both for the
But then what happens when the children are faced with kid food that comes in boxes on the grocery store, and as you say, those children's cereals are 50% sugar? How? I mean, if you're just leaving
So much of what's for sale as children's food, as we all know, it's you'd think it would be the very best food in our food supply, given the importance of children's bodies and growing, and the fact that they're actually learning how to eat, and in fact, it's the very worst food. And if you want to pick a really sugary cereal, go to the children's section of the breakfast cereal aisle. It's shocking, some of the foods that are marketed for children. And it's shocking not just for what it's doing for their bodies now, but the fact that it's training their palates to expect food to taste that way. And one of the revelations I had while I was writing the book was suddenly thinking, oh, lots of adults as well as kids are effectively eating a version of kids' food for the rest of their lives because that's how they expect food to taste.
And what do you mean by an adult version of children's food?
I mean, so there was a study done in 2010 by a couple of consumer scientists that said the taste preferences of childhood provided a new starting point for thinking about obesity. So if you look at kids' food, so much of it has that salt, sugar, fat profile. It tastes more or less of ketchup, doesn't it? And if you look at so many of the foods beloved by adults now, even ones who are, you quote-unquote, foodies or people who do actually cook, it's things like pulled pork with barbecue sauce. It's salted caramel, everything. It's kind of that salt, sweet taste of a hamburger, which we're gravitating towards, even as adults. And it's no wonder, because we learn how to eat, and the foods that we learn how to eat with are kids' food. But it's one of the many reasons there shouldn't be a category called kids' food. Sure, you need slightly different foods when you're just learning to eat as a baby. Your kidneys can't tolerate salt. But above the age where you can basically chew and swallow and eat solid food, it's just food. We're just the same, whether we're adults or kids. We don't need a separate category, but it's very cleverly marketed, and it's very hard for parents to avoid it. So when I'm saying feed without coercion, I'm not saying we should just feed kids anything, and that we should never encourage them to eat vegetables.
But wait a minute. Don't tell people what you're telling them until we get back from this break, so that that way they'll hang around and listen. And we'll get to Caprice's grandsons, too. Do stay tuned. Well, so much. I wish we had 3 or 4 or 12 hours to talk all day, B. Wilson, because what I found in your first bite was immensely fascinating for everything about eating and food. But we're going to go to Caprice, who has a grandson who has a problem. Caprice?
Oh, no, actually, no. He's a great eater. My question actually came about because I loved what you said. I've never heard this before, that between 4 months and 7 months is when there's a receptivity or a great interest in a lot of ranges of tastes. Is that that's what you were saying? And that's what I especially noticed with him was he would go out to their garden and he would eat kale raw right out of the garden, no problem. He would munch on, you know, things just right there, smell, you know, sage, and then have it in tea. And he was really receptive and open, and, you know, you could just carry him around everywhere tasting foods out of the garden. And then little by little, he has become more fussy, I guess you could say, and more particular and kind of leaning towards the carbs and leaning towards the dairy and really just kind of now. And now he's 2.
And right, so that's the classic age it's called neophobia. It is a classic developmental stage. And in the wild, in hunter-gatherer societies, it would have been a survival mechanism to be much more wary about food because that's the point that children were first tasting food that wasn't within the remit of their parents. So it was really useful to be wary, whereas now, as you say, it neophobia is something that makes kids kind of gravitate towards carbs and be suspicious of broccoli, which isn't such a great survival mechanism in today's food environment.
Well,
it sounds as if you're doing a great job, and you're somebody that started off sniffing sage from the garden.
Thank you very much for that call, Caprice. Really appreciate it. Now, B. Wilson, we figured out how to turn corn into sugar and put sugar into everything. So how do we teach children to eat when there is so much temptation?
I think temptation is the wrong way to describe it. I think you've half lost the battle at the point that you assume that the ultra-sugary foods are ones that you're going to need willpower to resist. Then you're in trouble. And if you're offering food in this way, which so many of us do as parents, because we feel that way ourselves, well, of course the child's going to pick up on the idea that these sugary foods are a super treat and we really want them. Even if the parent is simultaneously saying, I want to restrict the amount of that you're eating, and that obviously turns it into forbidden fruit. But I know from my own experiences with food, you know, I used to be a compulsive eater as a teenager. That's another part of the book, as you know from having read it.
Right.
And I wanted to look at how did I come to have now, I'm so grateful to say, a pretty happy and balanced relationship with food. And part of it was just learning new skills. It isn't that I now go past the 12-pack of donuts and exert willpower. I genuinely don't want to eat that. My palate has genuinely reached the point where I gravitate towards different flavors. So to answer your question, how do we teach children how to eat? Part of it is believing that we can teach our children to have a palate which isn't totally focused on sugar and all of these corn-based sweeteners with which the food supply is flooded. If you can somehow reach the point where, give or take the old plate of French fries, you actively prefer a plate of food that's centered on vegetables or centered on sort of proper wholesome foods like soups and stews, and where you actively prefer not feeling over full, it's possible to get better at learning hunger management. And these are skills we could teach to kids, but it's really hard for us to believe that because so many of us struggle with these things ourselves.
Amen. B. Wilson, thank you so much. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, B. Wilson, author of First Bite. Get it, read it, enjoy it. Thank you very much, B.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.